as the 1990s gave way to the early aughts, and as I made my way through high school, I began to discern in the news coverage on my mom's favorite channels, Univision and Telemundo, that there was something afoot, and that something was very ominous.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square, and thank you for joining us on this cold evening for a timely and hot topic. The title of our discussion, The Dream Machine, The Journey from Undocumented to Deported, sprang from the title of our main speaker's autobiography, Undocumented. I'm Mary Stack, the director of the forum, and tonight we're honored to have as our speaker a gifted Dominican native who arrived as a small boy in the United States, lived in a homeless shelter in New York, and now teaches at Princeton University, Professor Danelle Padilla Peralta. So first, a brief history. Back in 2012, the Obama administration established DACA to grant people brought to the United States before age 16 a reprieve from deportation if they met certain strict guidelines. DACA applicants, and there were nearly 1 million undocumented immigrants who came out of the shadows and applied, were assured that the personal information that they submitted would not be used to deport them. As a result, over 700,000 people were actively enrolled in DACA, and this gave them renewable work permits in 2-year increments. Last September, however, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that DACA would expire on March the 5th, claiming Obama had violated the Constitution in setting it up. This despite Trump's hollow rhetoric that we love the Dreamers, we think the Dreamers are terrific, and that he wanted a bill of love. Tonight, to help us digest this bill of love and understand our own moral responsibility in standing with our communities, we have the eminent academician and immigration activist, Professor Danelle Padilla Peralta.
Good evening, everyone, and I'd like to thank all of you for being here tonight to discuss immigration, and I'd like to thank Cambridge Forum for hosting this conversation. I arrived in the United States in 1989 as a 4-year-old with my parents. My parents came to the United States seeking medical care for my mom, who was pregnant at the time with my younger brother. And when we traveled to the United States from the Dominican Republic, where I'd spent the first 4 years of my life, our expectation was that we would not be in the States all that long. And we secured temporary tourist visas in order to travel. The expectation was that once my mom finished receiving prenatal care and gave birth successfully, that we would return to Santo Domingo. But this was not meant to be because, first, my mother became quite ill after giving birth to my younger brother. And secondly, because as she recovered, she and my father began having a series of conversations about whether they should stay. And there were a variety of reasons behind this conversation, reasons that had to do with the precarious state of their own lives in the Dominican Republic. But in an effort to get a clearer sense of their options and in order to begin the process of adjusting status, my parents started asking around, started posing questions to anyone and everyone in our community who might be in a position to help them. And in due course, they were directed to a friend of a friend of a friend who promised to lend his expertise and help them file an application to adjust status. My parents didn't really know how this immigration system worked. They found it cryptic. So they confided in a person who turned out to be a charlatan. He swindled them. He took their money and he left. And I would discover some years later that he had never filed anything. He had thoroughly and effectively conned them. This was my parents' initial exposure, to one of the many perverse incentive structures of our current immigration system, as it was already evolving into its current state back in the early 1990s. In its essential form, this perverse incentive system has to do with the fact that the current immigration procedures for adjusting status, if one should be fortunate enough to even be able to adjust status, are so dizzyingly opaque that it becomes quite easy for an entire secondary industry of con artists to emerge on the margins and take advantage of immigrant families. And not infrequently, these are con artists who are embedded in the very communities to which immigrants travel and in which immigrants set up their homes. This con artist was a fellow Dominican American, just like my parents. My parents weren't deterred by this experience, at least initially, but they did decide that they were going to stay in the United States and find some other way of resolving their status. Here's where they encountered a predicament that is familiar to many families. As a consequence of being swindled out of money, they didn't have anything in the way of resources to put food on the table, let alone to pursue the expensive adjustment protocols that would need to be pursued for them to secure status for themselves and for me. And so, for the first few years of our time in the United States, my parents took any and every job they could get in the hope of saving up money to pursue an adjustment of status, and in the hope of attaining the kind of stability that would enable them to set roots more firmly down in the United States. But a few years into this, my dad announced that he'd had enough. He was becoming increasingly frustrated by the fact that every few months he had to shuttle around from job to job because inevitably the question would be posed to him, do you have legal authorization to work? And he would have to say no. And so he hopped around from employment to employment until in 1993 he told my mom that he was headed back to the Dominican Republic and that if she wanted to, she could stay on by herself, or she could take my brother and me with her and join him back in Santo Domingo. My mom at that point did make the decision to stay, but that decision was not without consequences. She separated and then divorced from my dad. A few months later, after being unable to find the kind of employment that would enable her to keep making rent payments, she and my brother and I were evicted from our apartment in Queens, New York City, and ended up in the New York City shelter system. Now, throughout all this time, unbeknownst to me, there were developments in the political discourse underway, and these developments would have momentous consequences for the lives, not just of my family, but of many immigrant communities throughout the country. The first major development, which many of you will be familiar with, was one that on its face would appear to be a source of excitement and enthusiasm back in the 90s. And this was the election of a Democratic president who at the time was trying to position himself as a centrist with some liberal leanings. But it turned out that this Democratic president, whom I should note, proved to be very supportive of me much later on, was prepared to embrace a substantial amplification of the immigration qua deportation apparatus. And this was pretty ominous in light of what would happen down the road. So in 1996, a series of immigration reforms were passed that had direct and tangible relevance for families in my situation. One of these reforms imposed a set of fairly draconian penalties on families who overstayed visas, and this was our family. We had overstayed a tourist visa. As a consequence of these reforms, and as a consequence of a tweak to those reforms several years later, in the aftermath of an event that I will bring up in a moment, it became almost impossible to conceive of ourselves as adjusting status in any meaningful way, because in order to be eligible for an adjustment of status, my family would have to exit the United States and remain outside the United States for 10 years, which was the ban that was imposed on any families who had overstayed the visa past 180 days, as ours had done. So that was unfolding in the background to our lives, even though I could only dimly perceive as a preteen and then as a teen what was going on. more tangibly and more immediately in my life, there were these indications, seemingly incidental at first, and far more consequential later on, that pointed in the direction of a very turbulent adjustment to any sense of myself as a normal, standard fare American. Among the first of these was the disquieting realization that struck my mom and me when I was translating for my mom, that much of what we were able to access in order to keep ourselves afloat during the period that we were in the shelter system and in the period after we transitioned out of the shelter system rode entirely on the fact that my younger brother was a US citizen. So we were able to draw and benefit to a degree from the social safety net that existed in the 1990s and that has since been steadily and insistently chipped away, another development we can take up. But we were only able to do so because my younger brother had US citizenship. And at the time, I counted myself fortunate to be in a position where we could get a rent subsidy that enabled us to cover the rent after we moved out of the shelter system, to receive public assistance for the food that we had to purchase. But later down the road, this became one of those many moments where I was faced with an opportunity to re-examine what it meant to have the kind of hybrid split identity that I came to see myself as owning and having. Because in the end, what I was being taught over the course of the mid and late 90s, what I was being conditioned to recognize as fundamental to my existence as an immigrant in this country, was that I had at best, a second-class citizenship. And that citizenship was one that did not come with any of the emoluments of actual legal status. We did not have papeles at that time. It came only by virtue of the fact that we had in our family a US citizen who was able to open some doors for us at some points in time. After we transitioned out of the shelter system, I entered public school for fifth and sixth grades in Central Harlem in New York. And as a consequence of the intervention of a mentor who entered my life and my family's life while we were in the shelter system and who remained in close contact with us after, I was lucky to be admitted to a private school on Manhattan's Upper West Side, where I attended from the 7th to the 12th grade. As the 1990s gave way to the early aughts, and as I made my way through high school, I began to discern in the news coverage on my mom's favorite channels, Univision and Telemundo, that there was something afoot, and that something was very ominous. It was the amplification of the immigration apparatus and, concomitantly, the theatricalization of deportation as a tool for rendering explicit the state's violence in immigrant communities. Now, I knew this kind of state-sanctioned violence in a different context. We had grown up, my brother and I and my mom, in neighborhoods that featured a very heavy police presence, and I was accustomed to seeing police all over the place. But starting in the early aughts, the idea that ICE could come around, or that the predecessor of ICE could come around and round up families in my community took on more tangible form. And it really took on tangible form after an event that changed the lives of many in this country and beyond forever, an event that occurred in September of 2001, and that's 9/11. So 9/11 had several consequences, and obviously all of us in the room are familiar with the degree to which 9/11 transformed our political and civic discourse, destroyed lives, and left a wound that is still imperfectly healed. In the specific context of immigration, though, it was 9/11 and the political transformation set in motion afterwards that led to the passage of the Patriot Act, and with the passage of the Patriot Act, a substantive restructuring of the immigration apparatus and of the deportation apparatus in particular. And it is from this 2001 moment that we can see the emergence of a system for detaining incarcerating and deporting immigrants, whose work at scale and in terms of order of magnitude represented a significant departure from anything that had preceded it. This would culminate in a substantial climb in deportations under Obama's administration, and that's something I'll have more to say about in just a few minutes. But in the near term, it also meant that for me, as a person who by this point was getting ready to finish high school and head off to college, the specter of the deportation apparatus took on an insistently menacing feel. It was, in fact, impossible not to be anxious about what it would mean to encounter one of these officials. It was impossible not to think that at some point down the road, there would be someone sent from ICE or USCIS who would be in a position not only to isolate one's family, but in time to remove us from the country entirely. As all of this was humming along, I was applying to college, and thanks to the support of a college guidance counselor at my private school, I was admitted to Princeton, where I began as a student in 2002. As I was making my way to Princeton, there was another development that seemed at first to have something to offer me and other similarly situated folk, one that held a great deal of promise for undocumented youth like me. And that was the introduction of the DREAM Act, which was introduced in Congress for the first time in 2001 and was introduced every year thereafter into the early years of the Obama administration. And this act offered a pathway to status for undocumented youth who met certain criteria, who had been enrolled in school, who showed that they had no criminal record, who fell within a certain age range. And as activism for the DREAM Act intensified, and as a community of supporters of the DREAM Act began to materialize, it became increasingly possible to envision the DREAM Act as having some hope of political success, or at a minimum, some hope of discursive viability. It was possible to construct a case around the merits of the DREAMers, to place an accent on the nature of their contributions, to insist that in their educational achievements, in their prospects for employment, and in everything that they had done to engage themselves civically, they represented the best of America. But what many of us weren't fully conversant with at the time, I think, or what many of us came very slowly to recognize some years down the road, was that in advocating for the DREAM Act, something that I began to do in the late stages of my college career after I came out as an undocumented immigrant in 2006, we were being pitted against members of our own families, members of our families who did not qualify for the DREAM Act, members of our families who were no longer young, who did not meet the criteria, who did not fit conventional metrics of success or attainment of achievement. And this introduced all kinds of moral ambiguities that did not lend themselves to ready simplification, let alone resolution. These were the kinds of moral ambiguities that forced quite a few of us to begin questioning whether the DREAMer label made sense. And so, on the one hand, beginning in 2006 and continuing every year after that, many of us really became more and more committed to the necessity of arguing for and justifying the nature of the undocumented young contribution to this country, while at the same time feeling that we were becoming beholden to a kind of transactional economy in which our achievements would be used to sideline, denigrate, isolate, detain, corral, and ultimately deport those who are not DREAMers. Nowhere has this kind of explicit transactionality come more vividly to the fore than in the current administration's efforts to pit DREAMers explicitly against those who would be targeted by enhanced enforcement. But before we get to that, I have to say something else about what preceded this administration's term. In 2006, I graduated Princeton, and with my graduation, I was forced to contend with the fact that now being out as an undocumented immigrant, my chances of securing employment and building a life for myself in the United States were not particularly great. After weighing the options, I decided in late 2006 to depart the United States while still being undocumented and pursue my graduate studies in the United Kingdom thanks to a fellowship that Princeton had provided me for study there. When I arrived at the United Kingdom, one of the first thoughts I had was, how will I get back to the United States to see my mom and to spend time with my family for the holidays? And initially, my feeling was that it wouldn't hurt to at least try to apply for a tourist visa, even though at that point I was under the 10-year bar. Having overstayed my visa as a kid, I was subject to the 10-year bar like anyone else, and leaving the United States meant that I had put myself willingly in a position to have to heed the 10-year bar. But I thought when I got to the UK, maybe, just maybe, there will be a way out. Maybe, just maybe, someone will be considerate of my application the day I submit it. Maybe I can line up some support in the form of mentors and letter writers who might attest to my desire simply to travel to the United States from time to time. And you'll be unsurprised to learn that on my initial application to return to the United States, I was immediately and flatly rejected. I was rejected because, well, the 10-year bar is a very real thing. And there was no desire on the part of the State Department or of the U.S. Embassy in London to recommend me for what's called a waiver of inadmissibility. The only thing that made it possible for me to re-enter the United States and down the road to adjust status and to pursue a life that culminated with my getting a doctorate at Stanford and that has now had me teaching at Princeton after a stint teaching at Columbia was that I was readmitted to the United States with a work visa, and with that work visa, the possibility of a waiver of inadmissibility, which is granted to me not once, but twice. For this to have even been possible required the efforts of lawyers, who are incredibly sophisticated and adroit at navigating the system, and more than anything, it required capital. It required the support, the monetary support of institutions that were willing to bat for me and were willing to see the various procedures through. It also required luck. And this now brings me to the last point I want to make before I cede the floor. Over the course of the past 10 years, there has been a dramatic uptick in the scale of deportation. This uptick really, really took an ominous turn for the worse in the early stages of President Obama's administration. The idea behind increased enforcement in the early years of Obama's administration was that with a record of stringent enforcement to hand, President Obama could then turn to Republicans who were calling for increased enforcement and attempt to broker some kind of bipartisan deal that would feature relief for undocumented youth and at the same time some measure of increased enforcement that would be authorized through greater funding allocations, and that would also involve the strengthening of USCIS through more hires. For some, this kind of deal represented a viable, effective compromise that would provide some guarantees to the undocumented, or at least a class of undocumented, and that, at the same time, would cater to the demands of some Republicans for greater enforcement. Well, guess what? People got deported, and there were Republicans who didn't want to play ball. So in the end, hundreds of thousands of people got deported from 2009 to 2012. Ultimately, the Obama administration was responsible for the deportation of over 2 million people. And there was no legislative compromise. Faced with insistent activism on the part of Dreamers and their supporters, President Obama in 2012 did finally, via executive memorandum, implement DACA. And DACA is now what is under siege and under assault. But it should be borne in mind that DACA is, at best, a patchwork solution to a problem that affects 11 million people, and that those of us who are committed to the protection of undocumented youth also have to be committed to the protection of all of the undocumented, and that furthermore, we are in a position where the call to become responsible and engaged citizens will, I think, entail a revolutionary politics when it comes to immigration rights. In the end, the game that has been played for over 15 years is a game that attempts to isolate certain categories of immigrants as deserving and certain categories of immigrants as undeserving. There are many, I'm sure, here who will find that on some visceral level this makes sense, but I'm sure that there are quite a few of you here who feel that on a visceral level this kind of selectioning, this kind of categorization and taxonomy is ethically problematic, if not repulsive. And it is with that in mind that I turn to the last comment I'll make. Earlier, I mentioned that the opacity of the immigration apparatus creates situations where some members of the community can profit off the asymmetries of information that exist in the context of immigration. In the context of contemporary immigration reform, the true story that I think calls all of us to be attentive, and the one that I think will be showcased in our conversation, is how, if at all, local, municipal, and state actors will rise to the challenges of the contemporary moment. And this is all the more important in light of the broad trajectory of federal policy that I've underlined and that I've sketched very impressionistically. And we are fortunate to be in a town and in a state that has sought to protect undocumented folk and to take what steps it can to ensure that these folk are as sheltered from the violence of enforcement as possible. But, and this is the big but, at multiple junctures in the next few years, the prospect of some kind of grand bargain will be dangled before those of you who are in a position to exercise the franchise. And when that prospect is dangled before you, the question that you will have to ask is whether it makes sense to you as a matter of ethics to prioritize the well-being of some undocumented folk over the well-being of others. And that question is exactly the question that we have to contend with in this contemporary moment, not least because the federal policies in place and the thrusts of federal policies about to materialize are going to insistently force this kind of choice on the part of the electorate over and over again. And so it is with a heavy heart about contemporary developments, but with the hope of optimism, the hope and optimism that local and municipal and state initiatives will provide some kind of counterweight to the perniciousness of federal policy, that I cede the floor. I thank you for listening.
You've been listening to The Dream Machine, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square in March 2018 with Danelle Padilla-Peralta, Princeton professor and author of Undocumented. We are co-sponsored by the Lowell Institute, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, and Friends of the Cambridge Forum. Thank you for joining us.